Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today about the current state of labor in America with Stephen Greenhouse, senior fellow at the Century Foundation, a reporter with the New York Times for 31 years, covering labor and the workplace there for 19. And you can learn more about Stephen's current work at TCF.org. That's the Century Foundation, where, as I said, he's a senior fellow. And then you just search for Stephen Greenhouse. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. When Stephen Greenhouse and I spoke in the early days of the Biden administration in the spring of 2021 about his 2019 book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor, my introduction included the following framing. So I'm going to be quoting from how I set up the 2021 conversation just to sort of look at contextually where we were then and where we are now. In 2021, I wrote, "The years from the end of World War II through the early 1970s are thought of by many as America's golden age, though these were not the best of times for people of color, women, or the environment, to name a few exceptions. Employment was solid and reliable. A family could survive on one salary. The U.S. was leader of the world in many categories, and at the core of all of it was the greatest middle class the world had ever seen. Two things many don't know or don't want to talk about. Taxes were high, really high at times, and unions were strong. As a nation, we were prosperous, and perhaps because we'd gone through the Depression and World War II together, we shared that prosperity. Two things happened in 1970 that set us on a course that broke that social compact. Milton Friedman in a New York Times op-ed declared that the sole purpose of corporate behavior was to enhance shareholder value. And attorney and soon-to-be Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell wrote the Powell Memo, advocating that business redefine its relationship to politics and government, seeking every possible advantage. Both of these ideas were adopted and executed with a vengeance. It is no coincidence that the U.S. has the weakest worker voice of any industrial nation and also the greatest income inequality. I've taken it as a given for decades. This is what I wrote in 2021. I've taken it as a given for decades that the labor movement in America, especially in the private sector, is losing members, power, salary, and conditions, that it's only getting worse, and that the country is suffering because of it. The weakening of unions accompanied the Democrats' moves toward Wall Street and paved the way for Donald Trump. So I set up that conversation with these two questions. Given how clearly labor unions improved employment conditions for hundreds of millions of laborers, why did those same workers surrender to the corporate government plan to eliminate those unions? And two, what do we do about it? Can our shared vulnerability and experience of the pandemic and its destruction of the economy echo the post-war experience? Are these two simultaneous crises big enough to open the door to real change where labor is concerned? And if so, how do we best take advantage of that? Those were the questions that drove the conversation in 2020. Now I'm going to quote a few things that Stephen says in his book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, or in articles that he put out surrounding its publication in 2019. These were the facts. The share of national income going to business profits has climbed to its highest level since World War II, while workers' share of income, employee compensation, including benefits, has slid to its lowest level since the 1940s. Labor share of national income has fallen at a faster rate in the United States than in any other major industrial nation since 1995. Congress hasn't raised the minimum wage in a decade, the longest stretch without such an increase since the federal minimum wage was first enacted in 1938. One state legislature after another has passed right-to-work laws to undermine unions. America's unions and workers have less power in policymaking in the workplace than they have in decades. The percentage of workers in unions is at its lowest level in over a century, down to 10.5% from a peak of 35%, and just 6.2% of private sector workers, down from a peak of 35% in the 1950s. In the 2015-2016 election cycle, business outspent unions 16 to 1, $3.4 billion to $213 million, according to the Nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics. And each year, the nation's unions spend about $48 million lobbying in Washington, while corporate America spends more than $2.5 billion, more than 50 times as much. As a result, wages have stagnated for decades, income inequality has soared, corporations and billionaire donors have undue sway over our politics, policymaking, and political appointments. So that was 2019. And some of those markers are probably the same today or worse. But unions are winning these days in a lot of ways, achieving recognition of transformations in the workplace, winning good contracts, winning strikes when necessary, and perhaps most critically in the big picture, winning popular support. And the question for Stephen Greenhouse in 2023, things are getting better, aren't they? It's not just a media narrative of my confirmation bias, right? If so, how are they getting better? And I mean how in two ways. How, what's the evidence? And how is it happening? What's bringing this to bear? And finally, what can we hope for? And what can we do to make what we hope for more likely? Stephen Greenhouse, a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, was a reporter for the New York Times for 31 years, covering labor in the workplace for 19. He also served as a business and economics reporter and a diplomatic and foreign correspondent. He's the author of The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker, and Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Welcome, Stephen Greenhouse, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Very nice to be here, Terrence, and thanks for all those very tough questions. Fastball, curveball, slider, hard to swing at them all at once, but I will do my best.
Yeah, well, I'm just setting up for the listener that that's kind of what's behind whatever the individual questions are. Those are the big ones we're trying to get at here. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Tuesday, October 17th. So I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas we talk about. And so I always like folks to talk a bit about their path. And so with you, how did you end up focusing on labor and once there kind of carving out that as your turf? How does that happen to a young reporter? And then how does a maturing reporter decide, this is my beat. This is where I'm staying.
Okay. Good question. I'll try to keep this to 2 minutes, not 20 minutes. So I grew up in a lefty household on Long Island. My parents grew up in New York in the Bronx, both from quite poor families. My father's family was extremely poor during the Depression. His parents didn't have enough money to feed him and his brother, so they moved him to an uncle's house for a while. So my father, you know, was a lefty, very pro-union. So when I was growing up, you know, we listened to Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie and the Almanac Singers and Lead Belly. And, you know, we talked about unions. My father became a teacher. He was vice president of his teacher's union. Sometimes he'd take me to civil rights protests, sometimes to anti-Vietnam War protests, sometimes to union rallies. So I kind of knew about unions, you know, far more than most kids
right,
my age.
Right.
So I wasn't, you know, I was in college. I, you know, didn't do much about unions, so I decided to become a journalist. I went to law school. I focused on labor issues and constitutional law issues. In law school, I realized it's more fun to be a journalist than a lawyer. I got hired by the New York Times. I felt very blessed. I worked there before law school too, and some editors smiled on me. So at the Times, I first covered business, the steel industry, basic industry. Then I became the Midwest economic correspondent based in Chicago. Then I was the European economic correspondent based in Paris. Then I was in Washington for a few years covering diplomacy, the State Department, and the Federal Reserve and economics. And I wanted to write about human beings again. I was covering the State Department and negotiations and Haiti and the Middle East. And I just missed writing about people being out on the street doing street reporting. And the labor beat was open. And not many other people were interested in labor, but I was. And you know, one of my very best friends said, Steve, you are a New York Times Paris correspondent. You are a Star Economics correspondent. Why would you want to cover labor? It's just not a sexy beat. And I said, I think it could be a great beat. It's, you know, there are 150 million workers in the United States. There are great stories how farm workers are exploited, how some companies cheat workers by not paying them the minimum wage. You know, safety problems on the job, the disproportionate number of deaths of Hispanic workers. And I began the beat in 1995, and I did it for 19 years. And I joke to people and say, if I had done a really great job on the beat, I probably would have, you know, been moved to be London bureau chief or White House. You know. And if I had done really lousy, they would have, you know, snatched me away from it after a year or two. But, you know, I love covering labor because they wrote about how average Americans are doing. And I wrote about, you know, some places like Costco and Patagonia that do a wonderful job in how they treat their workers. And I wrote about other companies like Walmart that did not do a great job in how they treated their workers. I did this big story about how Walmart would lock its workers in at night. So, you know, I wrote about a worker who broke his ankle in the middle of the night and he wasn't able to go to the hospital because he was literally locked in and he was told, if you go out the fire door to head to the hospital, we're going to fire you because there was not a fire. So I found there are a lot of great policy stories, a lot of great, you know, profiles of labor leaders and of average workers. And, you know, I became the dean of labor reporters in the nation. And at one point, when the LA Times got rid of its labor report, you know, back in the, you know, 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, you know, every newspaper had a labor reporter when unions were growing, when there were all sorts of strikes, when Walter Ruther, the United Auto Workers, was, you know, one of the best known figures in the United States,
yeah,
along with Jimmy Hoffa of the Teamsters. But come the 1990s, 2000s, a lot of newspapers downsized their newsroom, and often among the first beats reporters to go were the labor reporter. And at one point, I was the last full-time labor reporter at a daily in the nation. The Washington Post,
God,
the Detroit Free Press, the Chicago Tribune, the Wall Street Journal no longer had one. So I felt kind of I was, you know, carrying this big burden. I mean, happy to do so. Like, I am the guy who is trying to tell the nation what's happening with workers, you know, how inadequate the minimum wage was, how too many employers didn't pay nearly enough attention to ensuring that the workplaces are safe, how, you know, there are models of labor management cooperation that lead to better profits and better productivity and better services to customers, to consumers, and how that could be a model. And there was a wide range, a panoply of really good stories to write about. And you know, my friends who initially said, Steve, you know, you have better things to do than cover labor. You know, you should have a better beat. They said, and I'm going to blow my own horn a second. You know, they said, you know, I was wrong. You're doing a very good job. It could be a great beat, and you turned it into a really important beat.
Okay. And a couple of things that come up for me in that. One, I hadn't realized the almost complete loss, almost total loss of labor reporting in newspapers. Obviously, there was a concerted effort, as I talked about in my introduction, to minimize labor's power, labor's influence, labor's membership, to exploit people outside of unions and minimize the ability to join unions and so on. But for all of the newspapers to decide this wasn't worth covering, What was going on there? When I hear how stark it was, I think, but most of their readers are workers, you know?
That's a great question, Terrence. So I think part of it is that, you know, in the 1930s during the Great Depression, there was this huge surge, you know, there were huge protests about poverty and unemployment, and there was this huge surge of unionization, you know, the Flint sit-down strike, the great strike in 1936-37 that unionized General Motors, the nation's largest company. That was front page news across the nation. There were other big famous strikes that were front page news across the nation. So labor was hot, sexy, you know, kind of the new thing in the 1930s and 40s and 50s. And like every newspaper had to have labor reporters. Unions were really in the news, making news. But unfortunately, in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, 90s, unions, you know, were less in the news. They became somewhat too bureaucratic, somewhat less willing to stick their necks out to try to organize people, to try to engage in strikes. So I think, so some publishers and editors decided, you know, we don't need labor reporters so much anymore because unions aren't so much in the news. But a second thing is that newspapers increasingly focused on upscale readers.
You
know, so they ran more travel stories, they ran more cooking stories, they ran more stories about how to play bridge or whatever. And they focused less on stories that the working class would be interested in. So I think that's another reason that unions got less coverage, and publishers, editors said, you know, let's focus on stories that attract our interest, our upscale readers, and stories about workers dying on the job or efforts to unionize these workers so they're paid $1.25 an hour more. You know, we don't need them that much. And I think also some newspapers and publishers were hostile to labor, hostile to unions, and they thought, you know, we don't need this stuff. You know, it's going to help the Democrats. It's going to help the working class. It's going to make my golfing buddies, my fellow CEOs unhappy. So I think, plus, the nation's newspapers, you know, hit a real financial crisis as Craigslist and Google and you know, Facebook took many, many ads away from them. So there are massive layoffs. You know, many newsrooms laid off half or two thirds of their employees, and among those who were the first to go, unfortunately, were labor reporters.
And you took a buyout in 2014, right?
Yes, yes.
What was that like for you?
I loved working at the New York Times, and I thought, and this will sound self-important, I thought what I did was important. You know, I was trying to bring to the nation's attention, as presumptuous and asinine as that might sound, I was trying to bring to the nation's attention what I thought were important stories about workers. You know, I wrote this story, you know, looking at some statistics showing that the fatality rate for Hispanic workers on the job is more than twice that of Caucasian workers. And that got a lot of attention. And then, you know, suddenly the federal government's paying more attention, like, what can we do to reduce this gap? And you know, I brought a lot of attention to how Walmart was squeezing its workers, and how some very, very well-known companies like Toys R Us were, you know, cheating its workers, of how managers were erasing hours from workers' time cards. And you know, people paid attention to these stories, and that helped bring about some changes. I must confess, I'm a workaholic. I work very, very hard. And for 31 years at the New York Times, I was a super workaholic. I was one of these jerks who, you know, didn't take all the week's vacations he was entitled to. I always call myself the boy who can say no. People saying, here's a good story, here's a good story, here's a good story. And I would write some years 250 stories. And so the Times offered a buyout, which is basically equal to 2 years' pay. And that's attractive. And two of my good friends, I was 63 years old. Two of my good friends had just died of cancer. Two of my journalism school classmates. And I said, you know, I've been on this frenzied merry-go-round for 31 years now. Let me get off. As much as I love this job, you know, let me do something different for a while. Plus, you know, I had this book contract. And I figured if I were to stay at the Times, I probably would not have been able to stay at, you know, probably would not have been able to write the book.
And so that book that we talked about.
Beaten Down, Worked Up.
Beaten Down, Worked Up. That really benefited from this buyout, because at that point you basically have a stipend, sabbatical, whatever you call it, to write this book.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, I would tell people, being the labor and workplace reporter for the New York Times for 19 years was like having, you know, back-to-back postdocs. You know, just I'm really able to study up very hard on what's happening. And I had, again, I'm going to sound presumptuous, you know, I thought I had a lot of knowledge and I wanted to convey it to people. And my editor at Knopf said, you know, write a history of labor. And I said, other people have written terrific histories of labor. Let me do something different. And I set out to write a book that, in which the first third explained, you know, how worker power is built in the United States. You know, what created unions, how they grew much bigger, and how they really improved the lives for tens and tens of millions of Americans and their families. And the second third of the book was really about the war, the corporate war to beat down unions and why unions, you know, grew much weaker, you know, between, say, the 1970s and the past few years. And the third part of the book was a more hopeful part, saying, here are examples, you know, despite all this corporate resistance to unions, here are examples where unions still can work, still can thrive, still can lift workers, still can foster great cooperation between workers and communities to improve schools, you know, to improve public services. And, you know, the book was well received. Unfortunately, the pandemic came along, which made it much harder for me to peddle the book. But I really thought, you know, the book served the public by explaining, folks, we see that workers are very unhappy. They're unhappy about increased income inequality. They're unhappy that for many of them, their pay is not keeping up with inflation. They're unhappy that CEO pay is soaring, corporate profits are soaring, Wall Street is soaring while their pay is just creeping along, inching along. And here are some ways to help fix the economy, to fight inequality. And, you know, I interviewed one fast food worker who helped found the Fight for 15 at Terrence Wise in Kansas City. And he used to tell me, you know, when Terrence was fighting for a $15 minimum wage and higher pay, sometimes, you know, customers would tell me, look, man, if you want higher pay, you know, you should go to college, you should get a degree, you should get a master's degree. And you know, Terrence Wise was a, you know, father of three beautiful little girls. He was working two full-time jobs, one at Taco Bell, one at Burger King. And, you know, he would love to go to college, you know, but like he was like 28, 29. And like, there's no way in the world right then that, you know, he could go to college. And I've, you know, spoken at radio shows. I've spoken, you know, on TV, and sometimes conservatives, you know, would say to me the same thing. These people don't need a union to get ahead. To get ahead, they should become lawyers or doctors or you know, software engineers. And I would tell them, you know, not everyone's as brilliant as you. You know, not everyone can, you know, suddenly can afford to go to, you know, Stanford Business School or Harvard Business School or get an engineering degree at MIT. And I say, you remember, every high school class has a bottom 50%. And a lot of those people are good, hardworking people, and they should earn enough to support themselves and support their families. And okay, they can't use the tool you recommend of getting an MBA from Harvard, but one tool that's very accessible to them to improve their lives, to help improve things for their kids, is a union. And that's what's really happening today, Terrence.
Right. I mean, obviously, the next question. Yeah, and I was going to say, your own personal experience has led up to it perfectly, which is basically, how do you describe and assess the state of labor in the U.S. today? And that sort of rhetorical question I said, things are getting better, aren't they? Tell us how you, as you look out now, and it seems to me those potentials and possibilities and outliers that you were citing in the third section of the book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, some of them, I'm guessing, has come to fruition or are coming to fruition even more than you expected. So let me throw that one at you. Where are we now, and how are we doing compared to what you were hoping for?
So, again, good question. So things are improving, but not nearly fast enough. And and in ways we're seeing important gains, and in ways we're seeing like a goal line stand by corporate America to prevent, you know, certain important gains by workers. And I'll discuss that in a minute. So when I, you know, my book came out in 2019, and it was a really frustrating time for workers. The Republicans were in power. The National Labor Relations Board was very anti-union, making it harder to unionize. The labor movement, labor unions, most of them were fairly unexciting. They weren't taking risks. They weren't spending much money on unionizing. And then the pandemic came, and you know, that kind of made everyone even more depressed. And the unemployment rate soared, and workers felt really set upon at work. On one hand, you know, the cashiers at supermarkets, the fast food, fast food workers, bus driver, you know, they're all hailed as heroes, but they weren't treated very well. And so, you know, things really weren't very good for workers in the last decade and the first year or two of this decade. And then coming out of the pandemic, things really changed. I think workers felt so angry and frustrated about how they were treated during the pandemic that they said, we want things to be better. We want higher pay. We want safer workplaces. We want more respect. And, you know, again, one of the crazy things is, as I said, you know, we hailed the essential workers. We called them heroes. They would go to work every day, risking their lives, you know, at the checkout counter, ringing up people's fast food bills, you know, driving a bus or a subway, working in the slaughterhouse. They were the heroes, but they, you know, they weren't getting much extra in the way of pay. You know, one of the things that really upset me in a profound way during the pandemic was we had all these wonderfully heroic essential workers risking their lives every day, and I don't even think 5% of companies paid hero pay. Mm-hmm. You know, an extra $2, $3, $4 an hour to thank these workers, to reward them for risking their lives and you know, making these companies profitable and keeping the economy running, while at the same time, the white collar workers, you know, were working safely from home, not having to schlep into work, not having to commute, pulling in $150,000, $200,000 a year, while the essential workers were pulling in $10 or $12 or $14 an hour. And I think a lot of rank and file frontline workers got very angry. So coming out of the pandemic, there was a lot of pent-up anger, and workers demanded change. And yes, there was the Great Resignation. Many workers said, it sucks how I'm being treated here. Pay isn't good enough. I'm going to go across the street and get a dollar or two more an hour. And some workers said, it sucks here. I'm not going to go across the street. I'm going to try to make it better here. Let's unionize.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so first we saw the historic unionization win in Buffalo, New York at Starbucks in December 2021. And that was hugely important. It's rare for a union, for workers to be able to win a unionization effort at a super duper anti-union company like Starbucks, because the company throws everything at you to try to stop you from winning. It sends in expensive anti-union consultants. It might fire a worker, fire some pro-union workers in Buffalo. It closed some of the stores that were trying to unionize. And yet the unionization effort won, and it really started to spread like wildfire. And then 3 months later, in early March, another historic unionization victory at Amazon in Staten Island. So, and Amazon was probably even more super duper anti-union than mm-hmm. than Starbucks. So you had these two, you know, iconic, well-known companies where the workers had won unionization drives, and that created a lot of excitement. So then we saw unionization efforts at Trader Joe's, at REI, at Apple Stores, at a Google subcontractor, at Chipotle. And so there is all this pro-union excitement, and there is more organizing going on than any time in many a decade. So in that sense, Terrence, there are real gains. Another big thing that your listeners, of course, know about, you know, there's been a real surge in strikes.
Yeah.
And that shows that workers are more confident. It shows that workers are angrier, more frustrated. And we first saw the burst of strikes in 2018 among the teachers. And
right.
You know, in red states, but in bright red states.
Yes.
West Virginia, Arizona, Oklahoma. And that helped embolden workers across the nation because they saw even teachers in red states could win. And what was underappreciated about the teacher strikes is the teachers worked very closely with the communities, with parents and students, and that really created warmer feelings about unions, that people saw that the teachers were just not fighting, were fighting not just for themselves, but they were fighting for better classroom conditions, better ratios of teachers to students, more money for extra resources for the arts and for libraries and for school psychologists. So that emboldened and encouraged workers. Then came the recession, then came the pandemic, and we've seen strikes, last year and this year, some really prominent strikes. We have the UAW strike now, the strike at Mack Trucks today as we speak, 3,700 workers at three casinos in Detroit walked out. There was, the Kaiser Permanente strike. In March, janitors and cafeteria workers at the Los Angeles Public School District walked out. They got a 30% raise. That ain't bad. Then there was, the 48,000 graduate students and postgrad students at the University of California walked out late last year, and some of them got raises of 66%. And so there's a lot more. And Kaiser Permanente had a three-day strike last week, the week before, and they won a 21% raise and a $25 minimum wage in California. And UPS threatened the largest, the Teamsters at UPS threatened what would have been one of the very, very largest strikes in the history of our nation. 340,000 UPS workers threatened to walk out. And they got a terrific contract, with raises averaging $7.50 an hour. The part-time workers are going to get a 48% raise on average over 5 years. So this shows that unions can really deliver. And while many companies and anti-union consultants that companies hire will tell workers, you don't need a union, they just want dues money from you so they could drive their Mercedes Benzes and BMWs.
Right.
You don't need a third party. I'm your friend. We're going to help you. We're going to raise your wages. And then when you see that, American Airlines pilots got a 46% raise in their contract. United Airlines pilots got a 40% raise. LA school district workers got a 30% raise. Workers at the Whitney Art Museum in New York just unionized, and in their first contract, they got a 30% raise. So this shows that unions can make significant gains. And when unions win, it's infectious. It encourages other workers to unionize and encourages other workers to strike. So in terms of organizing wins and wins and strikes, as you say, there've been important gains, there've been important wins. Now, the frustrating part is, so we've seen these historic unionization wins at Starbucks, Amazon, Trader Joe's, REI, Chipotle, Apple stores. At all of those companies, workers first voted to unionize between a year and 20 months ago. And not at one of those companies do those workers have a contract. So, workers unionize really for two reasons. One, to get a stronger voice on the job, to be treated with respect, and second, to make real economic gains. So yes, these workers, by unionizing at Amazon and Trader Joe's and Starbucks, they are being treated better, but they don't have a contract to give them the wage increases, the improved health coverage that they've wanted. And there's a big issue now where Starbucks workers, Amazon workers, Trader Joe's workers, REI workers, other workers complain that the companies don't seem to ever want to reach a first contract, because the companies realize that if we give Starbucks workers a good contract or Amazon workers a good contract, that's going to really encourage, inspire, embolden other Starbucks, Amazon, Trader Joe's, REI workers to want to unionize too. So, and many labor relations professors I speak to say there's a deliberate effort by many corporations to drag out negotiations as long as possible in ways to sour workers on corporations, sour workers on unions, to show that
it didn't matter.
You're enthusiastic about a union. You think it's going to help you, but the unions aren't going to deliver. And it's not the unions that aren't delivering.
Right.
The unions are doing their best. It's the companies that are dragging their feet and trying to do everything they can to reach a contract. Now, I should say, you know, Amazon will say, Starbucks will say, Trader Joe's will say, oh, we're all for reaching a contract. It just takes a long time. And I've been, you know, I've interviewed many, many Starbucks, REI, Amazon workers who say, bull, you know, at Starbucks, the first Starbucks store voted to unionize 22 months ago in Buffalo. And when I interviewed some Starbucks workers a few days ago, they say that Starbucks has not made a single, that the union has made various proposals, and in 22 months, Starbucks has not made one counter proposal to the union. And they show that, and they say that shows that Starbucks is really serious about never reaching a first contract. Starbucks says, no, we really want to reach a first contract. And you're probably going to ask me this, but I'll just jump in. So a big problem is the weakness of America's labor laws.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, let me jump in for 1 second and let people know that this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking today about the current state of labor in America with Stephen Greenhouse, senior fellow at the Century Foundation. He was a reporter at the New York Times for 31 years and covered labor there for 19 of those years. And you can learn more about Stephen's work at TCF, that's the Century Foundation, tcf.org, and then just search for Stephen Greenhouse. I just wanted to jump in on that. The one other thing I wanted to say was that hearing what you're describing, I can imagine the last year or so, you've probably had occasional itches to wish you were back on that beat full time.
I still keep my toe very deep in the water. I do a lot of writing still for The Guardian.
Right.
I did a big piece for Politico, the first big profile of Sean Fain, the president of UAW. I wrote about, you know, how Biden is, you know, in the UAW strike, Biden is being pulled one way by labor people, another way by environmentalists, all while Donald Trump is saying kind of a plague on all your houses. And I've been writing a lot about these historic unionization efforts at Starbucks, Amazon.
At the new economy.
In the new economy.
Yeah. And let me throw in one thing and then pick up your story again, which is how are these companies getting away with dragging their feet the way they are, agreeing to a contract and then or agreeing to negotiate a contract and then not playing ball. But I did want to say, I want to make sure that we touch on one thing that I mentioned in the intro and not let it go by the wayside, which is the resurgence, not just in the unions themselves, but the public opinion of unions has really jumped. And I'm going to read a couple of numbers and then you can grab that one and then we'll go into what needs to happen for the gains to really show up, which is some changes in the NLRB and things like that. Okay, so a 2019 Gallup poll found public approval for unions had climbed to 64%, which was close to a 50-year high. But in 2023, a polling conducted for the AFL-CIO, 88% of people under 30 approve of labor unions. That's basically 9 out of 10. 90% of people under 30 say they approve of strikes. Now, older groups, not so much. 69% of those aged 30 to 49 support unions. 67% of those over 50, the same. Strikes is higher, though, 72%, which I found interesting, that people are more in favor of strikes than they are in favor of unions. But 71% of Americans back unions. It cuts across party lines, 91% of Democrats, 69% of independents, and even a slim majority of Republicans. Support for strikes is at 75%. And people under 30 agree it should be easier for people to form a union, 70%. Unions are needed now more than ever, 77%. And an April 2020 poll found that 67% of likely voters, including 73% of Democrats, 64% of Republicans, said they would either strongly support or somewhat support a policy preventing employers from firing workers for any reason other than legitimate work performance issues. It seems to me, with something like unions, where you need, if you're going to win your contract or win your strike, the corporate boardroom has to think the public is on the side of the unions and the workers. These numbers make a difference, don't they?
Yes, they do. So I'm glad you raised this, Terrence. So over the past decade, we've seen a remarkable increase in public approval of unions. Back during the so-called Great Recession of 2007-8-9, union approval fell to 48%. At the time, Republicans were saying, oh, the reason your city, the reason the federal government faces a deficit is those damn unions. And it's not because tax revenues have fallen deeply because of the recession. They blame unions.
What I remember was the big boogeyman that you heard everywhere was pensions. We agreed to these outrageous things. Now and there was some reality in a certain economic moment. But yeah, I remember that as like so clearly. It was like, see what happens?
So the union approval rate in 2009 fell to its lowest rate since the Great Depression. But now it's like skyrocketed from 48% to 71%. So it's at its highest level in over 50 years. And so why is that? During the Great Recession, Republicans beat up on unions. GM and Chrysler filed for bankruptcy. Some people beat up on the unions. But I think over the past decade, over the past dozen years, typical Americans have seen, I'm not really moving forward economically. In many ways, I'm falling behind inflation. Yet Wall Street has hit record levels. Corporate profits have hit record levels. CEO pay is going up 20, 40, 50, 80, 100%. And a lot of people increasingly realize that something is really broken, something is unfair. I often think about, the Americans, watching an NFL game, an NBA game, a Major League Baseball game, and they're seeing their ads for Mercedes-Benz or for BMWs or for Viking River Cruises. And they say, who can afford this? I can't begin to afford this. I have a hard time, paying my rent at the end of the month. And they're feeling that they're not getting their fair share of American prosperity. And I think that's made people much more sympathetic to unions. And again, they're seeing things like the teacher strikes in Arizona, West Virginia, Oklahoma, Chicago, LA, and they see that the teachers are fighting to increase taxes on the rich in ways so that schools for average kids in West Virginia, Arizona, Oklahoma, Chicago, LA can get a better education. And I'm glad you mentioned that 88% figure, that 88% of Americans under 30 approve of unions. The enthusiasm about unions among young people is extraordinary. Not a word I often use.
Yeah.
So many young people just feel the economy is broken, is unfair. They watch TV too. They see all these commercials and say, I'm having a hard time getting ahead. I'm having a hard time getting a decent job. Unions are at least fighting to build a fair economy. I think there's something that we might call the Bernie Sanders effect. When Bernie ran in 2016, he inspired millions and millions of young Americans. He really preached the gospel about unfair income inequality. And I think a lot of Americans realize that income inequality is terrible in the United States. They see, these people, in their private planes. They read about Jeff Bezos trying to, shoot himself into space. And they say, again, there's something broken here. I'm making $10, $12 an hour. I don't have enough to pay my rent. I have to live with my mommy and daddy still. I don't have enough to pay back my student loans. We need to build a fairer economy. And maybe people look to Washington to build a fairer economy, but Republicans are refusing to raise the minimum wage. Republicans, took away this wonderful child care credit that
child
Biden
tax
and
credit.
Democrats pushed to make life better for millions and millions of working families with children. And I think Many people might have looked to Washington, looked to government as a way to improve their lives, but government is often not delivering, and they see one accessible way to improve their lives is to unionize. So one of the crazy things about Starbucks, so workers at over 350 Starbucks have unionized, and they're, you know, demanding fair wages. One of the very first demands by the Starbucks workers in Buffalo was they wanted credit card tipping. You know, they figured if customers could tip by credit card, that, you know, workers would get a lot more money. So Starbucks, in ways to, you know, stomp on the union, has agreed to credit card tipping at its 9,000 non-union stores across the United States. And that translates into an extra $5 an hour per worker.
Wow.
And that's great. And that's a union idea. And Starbucks has embraced that union idea, but is only giving it to its non-union workers. As for the 350-plus unionized stores, Starbucks is saying, you know, we're not going to give you the raises we're giving our, you know, workers on our non-union stores. We're not going to give you credit card tipping. We'll only do that through negotiations with you.
But we won't offer you.
but we'll never reach a contract with you. So they have this pincher strategy. Like,
yeah,
you know, we're giving all these goodies to our non-union workers. We're denying them to the unionized workers. We'll only give them to you once we reach a contract. But hey, you know, we might never reach a contract with you. So that makes it very hard. And, you know, the National Labor Relations Act, you know, which governs union management relations in the country, you know, makes it very easy for companies to drag their feet forever, to delay forever before ever reaching a first contract. Why do I say that? So, you know, under the National Labor Relations Act, which was passed in 1935 under President Franklin Roosevelt during the Great Depression to give workers more power, to give them more voice so that they could win higher wages to help lift themselves and the nation out of depression. The Southern Democrats who were needed to enact that bill didn't want to make it too labor friendly. So basically that law doesn't contain any penalties. So the law prohibits companies from bargaining in bad faith. Once workers unionize, a company is required to bargain in good faith. But hey, if you drag out bargaining for a year or 18 months, and the National Labor Relations Board rules that you are violating the law, you're not bargaining in good faith, all the Labor Board can do is slap you on the wrist and say, you got to go back to the bargaining table, and this time really bargain in good faith. And the company can just drag its feet again and not make any real proposals for another year or two. And the litigation cycle will repeat itself. And you know, the Labor Board will say, again, you got to go back and bargain in good faith. So there's a real incentive for many companies not to bargain actively, vigorously, to ever reach a contract.
So just so in case anyone missed it, the National Labor Relations Board, enacted by that law, can cite companies and do. I've got some numbers here. Where is it? I think they've cited Amazon at least 75 complaints against Starbucks.
Let me interrupt. Yeah. So there have been over 100 complaints against Starbucks alleging hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of law violations. And the Starbucks union asserts that the company has illegally fired over 200 pro-union workers, and federal labor law, prohibits companies from firing workers for supporting a union. And labor board judges have ruled that at least 28 of these workers were fired illegally. They're considering the cases of at least 70 other workers. The problem is, while the National Labor Relations Board is trying to do the right thing and litigate to have the companies declared to be violating the law for firing these pro-union workers, the companies cannot be fined one penny.
There is no enforcement.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. And this isn't like some little thing like, you know, I mean, I'm going to minimize something, but like, oh, there's no enforcement if you're, you know, if you don't have your cosmetology license, you know? It's This is millions and millions of Americans in every town across the country being screwed. The companies being able to be cited as you are doing something illegal that is criminal, and no enforcement. What can happen now as long as that is the condition, and what do we do to change that?
Great question. So I interviewed John Logan, chairman of the Labor Studies Department at San Francisco State, and he said, you know, Starbucks is carrying out one of the worst anti-union campaigns, most, you know, egregious, aggressive anti-union campaigns in decades. And he says that had Starbucks not engaged in all these aggressive anti-union actions, we'd probably see more than 3,000 Starbucks unionized already rather than more than 300. And, you know, Democrats, union folks have pushed for legislation that would make it easier to unionize. There's a so-called Protecting the Right to Organize Act that President Biden supports, that the House passed under Nancy Pelosi, but it hasn't gotten through the Senate because, you know, you're not going to get the 60 votes because you're not going to get 10 Republicans to support it. So, you know, that.
So
bill,
just remember, folks, yeah, we're in the Halloween season. That is another where the specter of the filibuster is what runs too much of this country, and not you, not even the people you elect.
So the proposed legislation, the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, would for the first time impose serious financial penalties against companies that break the law by, for instance, firing dozens of pro-union workers who are seeking a union. It would also say, that legislation would also say, look, companies that are delaying ever reaching a first contract for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, that if you do not negotiate a contract within 6 months after a company first unionizes, we're going to appoint an arbitrator, a fair-minded, neutral arbitrator, who is going to listen to both sides and then dictate order that this is going to be the contract, this is what I think is fair. And that will, you know, stop, you know, these long, you know, almost, you know, protracted delays where companies basically prevent unionized workers from ever getting a first contract.
Wow. And so that, and you're saying its full name, which is the
Protecting the Right to Organize Act, the so-called PRO Act.
That's right. I was going to say, for people, it's often called a PRO Act. So when a progressive says they're for the PRO Act, or when a Democrat says they're for the PRO Act, that's what they're for, is finally putting some teeth behind the National Labor Relations Board and actually making these companies actually pay for their crimes, or have their fates affected by their crimes. We've got about 4 more minutes. When you wrote the book in 2019, or it was published in 2019, of course you wrote it in the years before that, but you had this view of the future. And so let me ask you now, with the last 3 minutes or so, what do you see? We're at a propitious moment, although as we can see, not where we should be because of gaps in the law and so on, and gaps in the Congress. But what do you see unfolding, and what would be the best thing listeners could do if they want to help that unfold in the right direction?
Another great question. So there is all this excitement among workers right now. We're seeing a lot of workers going on strike, demanding better pay, better conditions. We're seeing a lot of unionization at places like Starbucks and Trader Joe's and REI. And there's a big question whether they'll ever get a first contract. And a very big issue, as we just discussed, is how do you get a first contract when the company basically refuses to move forward seriously in negotiations? So I think we might see workers at companies like Starbucks try to carry out a nationwide boycott.
That's what I was thinking,
As Cesar Chavez did with the farm workers, you know, more than 50 years ago. Because if the legal procedures of the National Labor Relations Act are inadequate to get companies to do the right thing, workers will engage in collective action to try to pressure them. A big, big problem I often talk about is, you know, big money, dark money, has far, far, far too much influence in our political system. And it, you know, why has our minimum wage not been increased in over 14 years? Is because, you know, rich donors and corporations tell Republicans, don't raise the minimum wage. You know, so what if some workers are making just $7.25 an hour? So somehow we have to, as a nation, overcome the stranglehold that dark money, big money has on our political system. And that ain't easy, because now we're seeing that dark money also has a very strong influence on the Supreme Court, which is very willing to uphold the huge power that the wealthy have over a political system. And in ways, I'm sorry to say, our country has turned from a democracy into a plutocracy. So we need more, you know, so what can your listeners do? You know, we have to stand up more to defend our democracy, to back workers who are pushing for better conditions, to improve things not just for themselves, but for consumers, you know, for you know, students at schools, you know, for people who take public transportation. And, you know, unions play, you know, unions are really the only institution in society that, you know, fights for the typical American, the typical member of the working class or middle class. And I think unions need more support, because they're trying to build a fairer nation, you know, where workers, where everyone gets treated with more respect, where there's less income inequality, and where everyone hopefully, you know, can make a decent living.
Yeah, no, I had in my notes here that when we spoke, and at the time of 2019, you actually said that the number one thing that people could do to rebuild the power of labor was campaign finance reform. And I just don't want that to be lost on people, that given the situation, that's what's needed number one, and that other things may follow from that. And then the notion, I know you either are right in the middle of doing an article on Starbucks or you just put it out, but if all the Starbucks on college campuses were boycotted, they would sit up and take notice.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Terrence.
Okay. Thank you so much, Stephen. Let me tell people, you can learn more at the Century Foundation, and that's TCF, thecenturyfoundation.org. Go there, search for Stephen Greenhouse. As he said, although he is not appearing in the New York Times 250 times a year, he is hard at work. And The Guardian is, I think, where I found the most. But as you said, you'll show up in Politico and in other places. And he gathers a lot of those at the site at the Century Foundation. The most recent book, and, you know, things have progressed since 2019, but still, it is a book that, you know, it's subtitled The Past, the Present, and the Future of American Labor. If you want to get up to speed, the book Beaten Down, Worked Up is the place to start. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or A World That Just Might Work.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually links to 10 or 15 articles to flesh out the conversation, you can email me at TEMcNally, TEMCNALLY, at mac.com, or you can sign up at my website, or at any, actually, you can sign up for the podcast at basically any of those podcast sites, but it's best to email me if you want to get that email. You'll find years of podcasts at my site or at those sites. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, George Packer. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. And thanks to Kiana Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners. please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Stephen Greenhouse, and keep up your good work.
Thanks so much, Terrence. Great to be here.